supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Public sector unions took a major hit today when the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that employees don't have to pay union dues or fees. As Keystone Crossroads' Avi Wolfman-Arendt reports, public school employees could be at the center of the fallout as they make up about a quarter of all union members in Pennsylvania.
In 1964, Roger Miller recorded the hit song King of the Road. It was about a vagabond, the type of guy who didn't bend to societal norms. I don't pay no union dues, I smoke. And in 1964, lots of Pennsylvania workers did pay union dues, approximately 38% of them. Today, that number is down to 13%. One of the last bastions for Pennsylvania's unions is the public sector, especially education.
I did join the union, as many new teachers do.
Keith Williams started teaching in Adams County, south of Harrisburg, in 2000. His union, the Pennsylvania State Education Association, is one of the state's largest, with over 180,000 members. But Williams doesn't like the union's politics, specifically the fact that they lobby for more public spending on education and tend to support Democrats.
I'm not a progressive liberal. It just doesn't resonate with me, and I didn't want any parts of it. So I got out in my second year.
After he left, Williams didn't have to pay full union dues, but his union could charge him what's called a fair share fee. The idea is that if folks like Williams are going to benefit from the contracts that unions negotiate for teachers, they should have to pay something. These fair share dollars can't be used for political spending, but Williams says money is money.
You know, I don't care if it's the air conditioning, I don't care if it's waxing the floors, buying toilet paper. You know, it's still supporting the infrastructure of that organization.
On Wednesday, in a 5-4 decision, the Supreme Court agreed. And Williams, who now works for an advocacy group that pushed for this outcome, thinks the fallout for teachers' unions could be major.
There are many union members who were not happy with the political stances that the state and national unions have taken.
Those folks might be tempted to leave, Williams thinks, or there could be others who simply want to save some money. But union leaders in Pennsylvania are defiant.
We all we got!
We all we got!
We all we need!
At a rally after the decision, Jerry Jordan of the Philadelphia Federation of Teachers brushed off concerns that Wednesday's ruling would weaken union power.
I believe that this decision has helped to motivate union members.
Right now, only about 3% of employees eligible for a Pennsylvania teachers union pay fair share fees. Losing those fees won't make much of a dent in union finances. But if this ruling triggers more departures, unions could start to feel a pinch, and it could limit their ability to do stuff like this.
It's a shell game. Governor Corbett cuts $1 billion from education.
That anti-Tom Corbett television ad was part of a push by teachers' unions to get Governor Tom Wolf elected in 2014. The unions also have significant resources to lobby state lawmakers for more education funding, less standardized testing, and limitations on school choice. Less powerful unions could mean less potent advocacy, and that could hurt Democrats. But unions say they're going to put up a fight, and that will start not with lobbying government, but convincing their own members to stay in the fold. Avi Wolfman-Arendt, Keystone Crossroads.
When a Pennsylvania child on Medicaid tested positive for lead exposure, the state used to pay for a home inspection to find the source. Now, the Commonwealth says that Medicaid insurers need to foot the bill, and that's changing how home lead inspections are getting done. From WITF in Harrisburg, Brett Schultes reports that the move is keeping some community-based lead inspectors from being paid and is putting more control in the hands of insurers.
Officially, I'm still the lead program coordinator, but my business cards say that I'm the maternal child outreach worker, because we no longer have a funded lead poisoning program.
Mary Lou Yingling has run York's home lead testing and enforcement program for nearly 30 years. She remembers when she had a 7-person team who would knock on doors offering to test homes and children for lead exposure.
Well, Well, at one point, I mean, there was three of us who had the ability to do the inspections, which wasn't so bad, but we were probably testing 4,000 kids a year because there were seven of us.
These days, she has a backlog of homes that need to be tested, and her department no longer gets paid for the work she does.
I've had maybe 15 referrals since the beginning of the year. I think I've been reimbursed for three.
She and other experts say this is important because children at risk for lead poisoning may not get the attention they need.
Ideally, we should go out at one blood lead level of 5 or greater. I can't do that just because of the caseload. I cannot get out to 200 children on my own.
She and a handful of others like her used to bill the state $350 for each home inspection. Now the state requires Medicaid insurers to pay for the lead testing. That's become a problem, Yingling says, because only one of the 5 Medicaid insurers in her area, Gateway, has agreed to set up a contract with her.
Well, the change is that we cannot bill through the PROMISE program.
In Harrisburg, Joyce Ravinskas runs UPMC Pinnacle's lead testing program. She's seeing the same problem, but on a larger scale. She and one other inspector do home lead testing for a 13-county region.
The Department of Human Services no longer pays for the EIs that we are doing.
Ravinskas says this new problem follows years of state and federal funding cuts for lead programs.
We decided that we would continue to go out, especially for any high lead levels. In that.
Joyce used to run a staff of 15 with field offices in Wilkes-Barre and Reading and $1.1 million a year in state funding. She lost that funding in 2016.
The Wilkes-Barre office actually closed, and the Reading office, well, it did close. It was being covered by Wilkes-Barre and Harrisburg.
And although the funding has stopped, lead poisoning cases have remained steady.
So in the Medicaid program, we pay...
That's Sally Kozak, Deputy Secretary for the Department of Human Services Office of Medical Assistance Program.
In 2016, we have slightly around 7,000 children that tested higher than a lead level of 5.
She says the state's 8 Medicaid insurers are free to contract with whomever they choose.
The managed care organizations have to have an adequate network to be able to perform the work. So they contract with whatever number of providers they need to be able to provide the service.
At least 4 of them have opted to hand most of their work to a private company in Delaware County called Accredited Environmental Technologies. AET Vice President Eric Sutherland and other company executives did not respond to requests for comment. Kozak says the state is responsible for making sure that the Medicaid insurers follow their agreements.
You know, we have a really rigorous contract oversight process.
But she says nothing stops those companies from denying an experienced lead inspector work.
The managed care organizations typically try to come to agreement with individuals that are willing to negotiate with them.
Department of Human Services spokesman Colin Day notes the families on Medicaid will still get their homes inspected when needed. But in York, Yingling says she worries what will happen when she retires in 2 years. She says many inspectors go above and beyond the bare minimum of home inspections required by the state.
I contact the doctor's office and say, here's a referral form. I need a referral for this child so that the kids don't fall through the cracks.
She notes research is showing there's no safe level of lead exposure for children.
So a lot of learning disabilities can be attributed to lead exposure. Behavior such as attention deficit hyperactivity.
Yingling says if she had the ability to make it happen, every child would be tested for lead exposure. In York, I'm Brett Schultes.
For a 6th consecutive year, Aikens Oval is a draw for pedestrians in the summer season. Joining me with details is Ellen Ryan, Senior Director of Strategy and Planning for the Fairmount Park Conservancy. Ellen, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks tonight.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
What's the strategy behind this project?
It comes from a study that was done in 2013 called More Park, Less Way. And the idea being that the parkway is vastly overscaled and is mostly devoted to automobile traffic. So this is really an opportunity to return more of that to the pedestrian, to the biker, and to have more fun, more things to do on the parkway except drive.
So I believe it kicks off July 20th and extends close to Labor Day.
That's right.
What are the range of activities?
So this year we have a theme, more park, more play. So we have a Mr. Pavilion, which will be really fun for kids to run through because it can be very hot. We're going to have a seating area that's made of a soft, spongy material, so it'll be fun for children to scramble over. And we're going to have a beer garden like we have in previous years. But the big news this year is we're going to be closing three block fronts of the parkway to extend the oval down the parkway.
Which blocks?
We're going to be closing from 20th Street all the way to the oval. So that's the block in front of the Barnes Museum, the Rodin Museum, and Von Collin Park.
So much to do and savor along the Ben Franklin Parkway, though some of the mega events obviously cause consternation with the residents and the surrounding communities. Is this project, though, intended primarily for those who live in the vicinity?
It is. And I'd like to quote Catherine Otlevel, the Parks Commissioner, when she says, lots of events happen to the community. The Oval Plus is an event that happens for the community. So we're just closing those northern lanes. So there'll still be, traffic will still go in the center lanes. But this is going to be allowing people to get on their bikes, to walk, to play, and have that so much more area available to them.
This is all being called an experiment. Toward what end? To potentially close it down for either longer periods of time or close more of the area down?
That's really what we want to see. And, since this is the sixth year, we really do, it's a pop-up, but we think of it as a pop-up with a purpose. We're really doing some diagnostics. And I think everyone in the city, certainly at the Fairmount Park Conservancy, wants to see some permanent improvements to the parkway and Eakins Oval to make sure that it's really living up to its reputation as a civic boulevard for Philadelphia.
So how have you measured success in each of the preceding 5 years, and what are your goals this time around?
Well, last year we did a terrific study with the help of Port Urbanism, who's our designer, and Penn Praxis at the University of Pennsylvania. What were the things that people really wanted to enjoy and we saw the most response to? So we're trying to build on that, and that's really why we have the play theme. But this year we're going to be looking at the traffic patterns as well and seeing how well the traffic does, if there's any delays or backups. We really want to understand, is there more than enough capacity on the parkway for traffic? And if there is more than enough, can we reclaim some of that for pedestrian and public use?
And who would the Conservancy have to appeal to make that argument?
We're working hand in hand with the great Parks and Rec Department. We're working with Mike DiBaradinas and his staff. We're working with all the public safety agencies to make sure we do this right. And we'll work with a consultant to do that study to make sure we understand what the traffic impacts are. So I think we have to make the argument to the city, to the neighbors, to the stakeholder institutions along the parkway.
Is that part of the reticence, convincing businesses that it's good for business to reduce car traffic?
It's making sure that all the institutions along the parkway who rely on buses and the flash service clarity and wayfinding, that they just want to make sure that their visitors can know how to get there. So we think that there's a variety of ways for people to travel, whether it be by Uber and Lyft, whether by bicycle, by car. There's many different ways. We want to make sure that those ways are preserved. But we do think that there's excess roadway that we can capture. And so many more people will come down because, part of the attraction is watching other people and having more food and restrooms and other amenities as you go down the parkway.
I hope whatever planning has to ensue between now and the launch all goes well.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank
you for joining us.
Okay. Thank you.
Ellen Ryan, Senior Director of Strategy and Planning for the Fairmount Park Conservancy.
Driving along the Schuylkill River on I-76 in Philadelphia this week, you may notice clusters of brightly painted floating balls bobbing in the water. They're tidal buoys installed by an environmental artist working with Mural Arts Philadelphia. WHYY's Peter Crimmins reports that they trace the natural forces of the constantly changing waterway.
The Schuylkill River runs through the heart of Philadelphia, and for hundreds of years, people have tried to contain it and control it for industry and recreation. Artist Stacy Levy says nobody puts Schuylkill in a corner.
This river has some serious moods to it.
Levy is rowing out from the banks of Bartram's Garden in southwest Philadelphia, where she has just installed a cluster of what she calls Tide Field. These are lines of styrofoam balls strung together resembling caterpillars reaching out from the water. At low tide, they all lie flat on the surface, and as the tide rises, the strings of buoys straighten up. It lets viewers track the tidal forces of the river in real time. The Schuylkill has a tide cycle of 6 feet, up and down twice a day. It flows north to south, but Levy wants people to understand that there are a lot of natural forces pulling the water in every direction simultaneously.
The wind currents are blowing one direction. The actual river current is flowing another direction. The tide could be pushing a third direction. And then there are kind of micro currents being affected by entirely other things, like the topography of underneath of the river. It's a myriad of things. The more time I spend in it, the less I know it.
Levy was invited to make tidal fields by Mural Arts Philadelphia and Bartram's Garden. She also designed seating areas along the river shaped like the bow of rowing boats to bring people closer to the water's edge to watch. The buoys will remain in the water until late fall. They can't survive the winter, so they'll be removed. Peter Crimmins, WHYY News.
That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yakov, Kimberly Haas, and Brett Rader. Find us on iTunes or listen back at whyy.org/news. Thanks for listening. I'm Dave Heller. NewsWorks Tonight.